Joining me now is the former editor-in-chief of the Toronto Star and the founding editor of the weekly news magazine Maclean's, Peter C. Newman. The journey from fleeing Nazism for Canada to conquering journalism's highest echelons, along the way becoming the nation's preeminent chronicler of its history, politics, and establishment, is a story of a life that's engrossing, dramatic, as well as often entertaining. He is honest about himself, and often brutally so. In 75 years of mischief and misdemeanors, he has had four wives and God knows what else, seven honorary degrees, known nine prime ministers, written 22 books that have sold over 2 million copies. He has lived to tell it all in his latest, a memoir, Here Be Dragons, Telling Tales of People, Passion, and Power, $42.99 Canadian, a Douglas Gibson book published by McClelland & Stewart. Welcome to the commentary.ca, Peter C. Newman. Good morning, Captain Newman.
Hi.
Your association with the Canadian Navy, not too many people know about that. When did that begin? Was that after you graduated from Upper Canada College? Or?
That's right. I had always tried to figure out, you know, since being an immigrant, and at that time there were very few immigrants, how you mark yourself as a Canadian. I mean, everybody looks alike, and how are people going to know I'm a Canadian? Well, I finally figured it out. The only way you can be sure transmitting that message is to wear the word Canada on your shoulder patch, and to do that you've got to join a service. So I became a member of the Naval Reserve, and I stayed there for 40 years, rising from ordinary seaman to captain. And but the main motivation at the beginning certainly was to identify myself as a Canadian.
And you've always had a love for sailing throughout your life.
Yeah, well, I love sailing. I love being on the water, and that was certainly part of it.
It's interesting. You quote Willa Cather in your book. Let your writing grow out of the land beneath your feet, but you've also spent a lot of time on water, haven't you not?
Well, I think she meant that was a metaphor for water, too. That's the way I was took it.
Really? Now, you don't live in Vancouver anymore, do you? Or?
No. We left about 3 years ago because my wife is taking a doctorate in medical psychology, and the best course was at the University of London, and so we have lived in London. And she has got one more year to go, and then we'll see what we do from there.
The title of the book, Here Be Dragons, would you explain that? That's a cartography term, is it not? Or?
Yeah, it's a very sort of antique phrase. What it was used for originally was in the maps that the early cartographers drew when they had no indication of what was out there. They still believed the earth was flat, and eventually the boat would go over the edge. And so they were warning people, warning navigators not to go too far, and if they didn't know what was out there beyond the horizon, they would just either draw dragons or write in Latin, Here Be Dragons. In other words, don't go there. And in my case, it wasn't so much don't go there, it was that there were a whole bunch of dragons trying to stop me, and some I conquered and some conquered me. For example, my first dragon was a Nazi Stuka machine gunning me on the beaches of Biarritz as we were trying to escape a war-torn Europe, and the dragon image seemed appropriate because he was spitting fire in the bullets really looked like fire to me.
Was it difficult for you to write about yourself when you're so used to writing about politicians and business leaders?
It was very difficult, partly it's a matter of energy. You know, when you're interviewing people, whether it's politicians or businessmen or whoever, you're basically using their energy. You're asking them questions, they give you answers, you put the answers together, and you make a book out of it. This time, there was nobody to interview. It all had to come from the inside. And what I believe is that too many people who write biographies or autobiographies try to make it all come out of the brain, and that's not good. I try to make more of it come out of my gut and my heart and write about my feelings. You know, of course I wrote about also what happened, what I thought about it, but mainly it's a feely kind of, you know, reading the vibes and telling it as I felt it rather than as I thought about it.
Did it take you longer to write this than, say, I wouldn't say normal book, but a conventional book that you would write?
Well, it took four years, full-time work, and it wasn't so much the length of time, because most of my books take that long, but it was the intensity, it was the concentration, and the sort of almost painful decisions having to make, you know, do I put this in, do I leave that out? And in the end, I put most of it in. I figured, look, I'm 75, I'm going to tell everything the way it happened, whether it's good for me or not. It's that kind of book.
And it was a cathartic experience, was it not?
It was very much so.
Your friend Douglas Fisher wrote in a review of the book that you could have easily split this up into two or three or four separate covers. Why did you write this book now? And as well, why at 75? Was it the right time to do that? Or
I think so. I mean, you got to say, well, I'm going to look back before it's too late. And this seemed like a good time to do that. In terms of what Doug wrote, I think it's enough to ask people to read 700 pages of one volume instead of going further. Sure, I could have gone on and on, but I try to distill what I thought was important to the reader and to me. And, you know, it isn't only about me. It's about the times. It's the life and times of Peter Newman. Because I lived through some interesting times. I saw Canada completely change. I saw politics revolutionized and business changed. And so it isn't merely kind of a plea bargaining that most autobiographies are.
Now, let's start with the dedication here. I found it incredibly poignant. To whom do you dedicate this book to?
Well, all of my family, except the four of us who escaped, my aunt and my mother, father, and I, perished in the Theresienstadt concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. And we went there, back there, my wife and I went back there, and we saw a board where they had the names of all the people who the Nazis had killed there, including 5,000 children. And by God, there were four or five people my age with my name, Petra Neumann, which was my name in Czech, who were killed in that concentration camp. And I came very close to being one of them. And so I dedicated the book to them, to the children who never had a life, heard birds or felt the gentle touch of butterflies, and I felt that they, in some small way, this would recognize their having lived.
So, I wouldn't say luck. Would it be luck that you managed to live, I guess, and have such a storied life? Or I don't know. That's probably too deep a question, is it not?
Well, you know, an autobiography is a difficult format because you don't know who's going to read it and if they're going to be interested. And especially a Canadian autobiography, because, as you know, Canadians are very self-deprecating and deferential.
Right.
And if you get too self-deprecating, people are going to ask themselves, you know, why am I reading this? So you have to be very positive in a way of telling your story, but you also have to tell stories, and that's my secret. I'm a storyteller, and I regard myself as a descendant from the itinerant Indian storytellers who moved around rural India before the age of radio and television and told stories. And they would arrive in a village at night. Villagers would sit around the campfire, and these people would tell stories and pass around a rice bowl. And if it was a good story, they'd get to eat that night. If it wasn't a good story and didn't keep people's attention, they would drift off into the night and they'd go hungry. So that's the kind of urgency I had about telling a good story and making it interesting.
Now, your childhood in Czechoslovakia before Hitler, could one say that that was a privileged childhood?
Oh, very much so. I was a spoiled brat. Look, we were living in a little town called Břeclav on the Czech-Austrian border, and it was a company town, and my father owned the company. So I had a petting zoo of my own. I had a little garden house. We had three maids and chauffeurs and two gardeners, all kinds of servants. It was the biggest house in town, the biggest fortune in town. And it all vanished in one day when the Germans invaded, and we escaped with a little suitcase each. And that's the story, is really, of the escapes, more than the life we had. And I was 9 years old when we abandoned that.
You know, I was reading the book about, when I started the book, I guess about a week ago, and that first chapter where you discuss that you're fleeing Czechoslovakia, coming to Canada, I put it down, and for the next hour or two, just sitting around, I couldn't get the images that you painted away from my head. It was just that potent and that strong, and
Obviously, that was a very traumatic experience in my life, and I try to capture that. But I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't make too much of it, because there are 6 million people who never made it that far and wish that they were in my place. You know, a lot of people were killed without a chance, and I happened to be lucky, and I happened to have a father who fought for us to get out of Europe. And as it was, we were one of only 7 families admitted into Canada,
really?
Jewish families, during the war. It's amazing.
Now, the Captain Canada moniker, you got that much later in your life, but on that beach, as you were, you know, you're still in Europe, I believe, you made that, you call it a childish resolve to pledge your loyalty to anyone who would accept it. Now, was Canada the beneficiary of your allegiance, I guess? Is that?
No question. You know, Canada saved my life. I mean, that's not a metaphor. That's a fact, because we try to get into Australia and the United States and Brazil and Argentina, just about every country, and nobody would have us. And it was only a fluke that we got into Canada, because my father was able to buy a little farm, just 15 acres, and we were willing to turn Catholic, even though it was a temporary conversion. And so it was just luck. It was pure luck and coincidence that we were there when these things were happening, and we could take advantage of them. And I've always felt that I owed my life, and I had to do something worthwhile to pay back to whatever deity was looking after me.
You just let's get into something else now. In each of your marriages, as I said off the top, you were married. You're married 4 times, and you discuss each one throughout the book. And I guess obviously each one were of some consequence to your life, not only, you know, to your life, but also professionally.
Yes.
Were they not?
No question. Well, the biggest influence, of course, was Christina, who is a wonderful, wonderful writer, much better writer than me, I should add. And she was the first Canadian, although I'd seen it in the United States, but she was the first Canadian writer to introduce me to that way of writing, that you write by describing your feelings, by your reactions to what's happening, as opposed to what some politician says, which is, in the end, is not very interesting, no matter who it is and what he's talking about, because probably written by some ghostwriter. And anyway, but what politicians say isn't important, it's what they do. So she was a great impact, and Camilla, who I married later, was a very good editor. And Alvi, who is my last-time wife, who I'm married to now and very happily, is not in the business at all, and I learned that. I think that it's much easier to and better to have a marriage when you have different interests than the same interests, because you tend to compete, and that's not a good thing.
I was going to ask about the... you were on Rafe Mayer's program a while back, and you said point blank, I love Canada, and then the callers called in and said, construe that as being anti-American. How do you explain that sort of sensibility that Canadians have?
Isn't that weird? The only country where you have to excuse yourself for feeling patriotic. And yeah, I feel patriotic. I love this country. And I once had made the mistake of, in a speech, saying I physically love this country. And Frank Magazine quoted me and saying, well, we'd give a nickel to see that.
You've written a lot about politicians, in your books at least, about politicians and the business leaders of the country. Do people ever ask why you didn't write about ordinary Canadians or ordinary people, if you will?
Well, you know, that's a very fundamental and very good question. And I believe that the way you study a society, and don't forget I'm a student of the society. I wasn't born here. I didn't speak any English before I came. And so I've always regarded myself as a kind of outsider looking in and trying to define what Canada's all about. And it seemed to me that one way, and it's only one way, but it was an attractive way in that it was controllable. You know, if you write about ordinary Canadians, you're writing about 30, 31 million people, and that's very difficult. But if you write about their leaders, what I call the Canadian establishment, then you have some entry point into studying what makes Canada tick, because their influence is multiplied. They have the kind of influence and power that makes decisions, national decisions. And I define power as the power to produce intended effects. In other words, if they want something to happen, it happens. Now, ordinary Canadians can, of course, do that as well, but it takes an election. It takes, you know, 30 million people voting to change things, and that's very difficult to define and to write about. So I chose the other way. I'm not saying that studying ordinary Canadians is not good or not useful or not possible, but I couldn't figure out how to make it meaningful.
Now, the establishment that you wrote about in, I guess that was the early 70s, through to the fourth volume, Titans, which came out, I guess, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
It obviously changed, it morphed, the players became different. Is the establishment that you covered nearly a decade ago, is that the same that we have now in this country, or has it changed?
Not at all. Not at all. That first establishment I wrote about in the mid-70s was a pseudo-aristocracy. It was a bunch of people who inherited power or who would inherit power. They were concentrated in a very few hands. They were judged by what clubs they belonged to, what private schools they had gone to, women they married, you know, all these external criteria. And they ran the country as a closed club. Now, what you've got is a meritocracy, which means that you have to earn your way into the establishment. It doesn't matter where you went to school or what clubs you joined or didn't join or who your wife is. None of that matters. All that matters is what you've done. And I think that's great. I think that's a democratization. There will always be an establishment. But when you have to earn your way in, I think the country benefits, and I regard the Canadian establishment as a floating crap game. Every 10 years it changes, with very, very few exceptions. There's only one person that bridges all my establishment books, and that's Paul Desmarais of Montreal, because he has been powerful a long time, and he's one of my favorite characters, because I think he has hurt the least number of people on his climb up into having assets of $100 billion.
And then a contrast to that, I guess, would be Conrad Black, would it not?
Yes, Conrad would certainly be on the other end of that. I did the first book on Conrad, and I take the blame or credit for inventing the Black myth.
Three books this season on him, so...
Yeah, and those other books on Conrad are very good, I must add that, because they have things that I don't have, and I have things that they don't have, but they really did a lot of research. And... I feel sorry for Black, because, you know, we seldom have such an intelligent, articulate person in our midst, and we will miss him, because, you know, we want somebody like that. The fact that his greed grew to proportions which are beyond imagination is sad, because he didn't need that. He had everything, and instead he threw it away, and we'll see in the next few weeks how these trials develop, so... Have to be careful what we say, because most of these things are accusations, but they will become charges, and he's going to have a very, very, very tough time wriggling out of them.
You devote a chapter to him in Barbara Email. I've read elsewhere that people, you know, say that, well, I'm going to ask how it figures in your life, why you add them, add them as a chapter to your memoir, but everybody seems to eat it up and really enjoy what you've written about them. Why did you include them in your, I guess this be your life story, your memoir? Why did they figure a whole chapter?
Well, because, you know, I go where curiosity leads me. And I was very curious how these people who had everything threw it away. And it's a good story. I don't mean it's a nice story, but it's a good story. It's an incredible story, and I tell stories. So I told it as best I could, and I was in a very favored situation, because not only did I know Conrad well, but I knew Barbara extremely well, because I gave her her first job. She worked for me for 8 years when I was editor of Maclean's. I know a lot about her, more than most people, certainly. And I was able to draw some very interesting profiles of her and her outlandish sexuality and, you know, all the intimate things that other people don't know.
And of course, your claim to fame is that you invented Conrad Black. Do you know?
Well, yeah, that's semi-serious because nobody invents anybody else. But as much as that's possible, I do take the blame because I was the first to write about him, and I was the first to set out the anatomy of how he gained the power that he gained and how he was able to do what he did. And I all those facts stand. I mean, what happened afterwards is a separate story that others have told. But I brought it up to date in this book because I felt I had to. I couldn't just leave him in his mid-30s. I had to take it to his 60s and all the things that happened to him.
Fotheringham wrote of you once as being able to fall asleep at 9:05 at a 9 o'clock movie. Yet when you're in front of a computer writing, you seem to take no prisoners. Could you explain that change in demeanor from you know, I guess, idle chit-chat to being Peter C. Newman, the columnist, the writer? Is there a change that happens there? Is the page sort of a cloak?
Sure. First of all, the time of day. I never write at night because I'm too tired and my brain isn't working. And when I was single, I used to go to bed, you know, at night, as always, about 9:30, and I would tell my dates, you know, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to work, so I'm going to bed at 9:30 with you or without you, and it was not a great not a great line. It didn't work very much, but it was true because I did get up at 4 o'clock every day to write because I always had two jobs. I was running Maclean's or the Toronto Star as well as writing, and it was a very tough assignment. But and there is a change. You know, what I discovered from doing this autobiography is that there are two Peter Newmans. There is Peter C. Newman, who is the tough columnist, and there's Peter Newman, who is human, and that's been the great advantage of my last wife, last marriage 10 years ago, is that Peter Newman is the person she married, and she never even knew about Peter C. Newman. So there are two people, but when I write, I still take no prisoners, and I write as harshly about myself as I do about other people.
Now, to live with, you probably like Peter Newman better than Peter C. Newman.
Oh, absolutely. For sure.
Now, Renegade in Power, that was your first book, and that was the look at Diefenbaker.
Yes.
Was that the first real book that, I guess, got you started, got you the notoriety that you have today?
Yeah, I had written a book before called Flame of Power, and it sold well, but it didn't cause nearly the splash that Renegade did. Renegade was a new kind of book for Canada because I wrote about politics as it was, not as, you know, some radical attacking the system or some people who's excusing everything and making it sound like these are the great statesmen. I just wrote it the way it was, and that was revolutionary. I don't know why it was, but nobody had done it before. Nobody had tackled these people as human beings with all their faults and all their weaknesses, and it was a different book, and it changed political reporting as Canadian establishment really changed business reporting.
What was Diefenbaker like to, as a person, to kibitz with, you know, one to one? Was it different than what we saw on TV and what we see in film?
Well, yeah. I mean, he had a wicked sense of humor. He was funny. He was also anti-Semitic, incidentally. But he was he was just, you know, he was a very interesting man who had lived a long life of great hardship. He had been attacked because of his name wasn't WASP, and he lived in a WASP part of the country. And I liked him, but I thought he was a lousy prime minister because he couldn't administer the process of government. You know, before he came to office, he had only run a two-man walk-up law office in Prince Albert, and suddenly he was running a $6 billion corporation, which was the government, and it was just beyond him. He couldn't handle it, and it was sad because I judge politicians not by what they do or what they don't do, but what they might have done. You know, and Diefenbaker had that great mandate, and Trudeau had it, and Mulroney had it, and I think all of them should have done more with it.
I guess Pearson did more with his minority than Trudeau, Mulroney, or Diefenbaker, right?
That's right, which is kind of paradox, because he never had a majority, and yet, you know, he gave us Medicare, National Pension Plan, the flag, and there's a list of about 100 things that he did, and they were all good for the country, and yet he never really had the power. He was a, and that's, I think that's because he was trained as a diplomat, and he got things through that politicians who didn't have that background couldn't handle.
You refer to Trudeau as Lucky Pierre, and you talk about this, and I don't think I've ever read this anywhere else, is the leak that he and Mark Lalonde gave you at the height of the October crises about Claude Ryan wanting to form a parallel government.
Yes.
And Trudeau lied to you.
That's right.
Did you ever figure out why he did that?
Well, you know, I'm sort of used to politicians lying. I think it comes with the trade. I remember the Sam Donaldson, the American broadcaster who attacked Clinton in the middle of the Monica affair, and somebody said, well, what's Clinton's problem? And he said, well, it's very simple. When Bill says, when Bill swears to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, he thinks there's three different stories. And politicians lie. That's part of their technique. And I didn't mind so much being lied to as lying to me, because, you know, we had been friends, and he was explaining in great detail, and Lalonde was explaining in great detail why they had to bring the country to the verge of civil war, which was because Claude Ryan was establishing a parallel government. Well, it turned out not to be true. And Trudeau said it wasn't true after telling me it was. And I thought, hey, this is a little too much. So I didn't quite worship him as much after that, although I still think he was a fascinating character.
Now, all the prime ministers, all the great leaders that you've dealt with, you've had the sense of, I guess, friendship as well as hope, and then it leads to eventually to disillusionment, does it not? And the same with Brian Mulroney.
Yeah,
you were friends with Mulroney, were you not?
Yeah, that's right, and that's what I'm saying is that it's not what they did or didn't do, but what they might have done with their mandate to make the country allow the country to fulfill its full potential. And that's what all I want leaders to do, is to take this country, which has the mandate of heaven, and govern in a way which will allow Canada to fulfill its potential, which is unending, which is tremendous, which is better than any country on earth. But they're always held back because they're too partisan and they're too short-sighted, and they're, you know, all they want to do is get reelected. And I want to see a leader who puts that national goal first, and I'm afraid I'm still looking.
And you don't see that at all in this current regime, do you?
No.
You were supposed to write the biography of Brian Mulroney, and in the book you mentioned that just never came through. Why not?
Well, I was hoping to get some documents, because I think what gives authority to a biography is not just the word of a prime minister or some of his ministers, but actual documents that people can see. And I'm not talking about, you know, secrets of state or defense or anything like that. I'm just talking about how decisions are taken and why and what they hope to achieve and what the next step would be and that kind of thing. And I was promised that, and he changed his mind and didn't give me any of those documents, so I felt I couldn't do the book. I could have done a book, but I don't think it would have been an honest book or a complete book, because I would never have known, you know, the facts behind the decisions, and that's what's important to me.
Now, you write in the book that you're working on two books at the moment. What are those about?
Well, one of them is the popular history of business, Canadian business. I don't think that's been done. Another one that I'm thinking about is the change in the world. You know, I see the 20th century as having been the century of the nation-state, and the 21st century is probably becoming the century of city-states. And there's an idea for a book in there, but I haven't formulated it yet, and I haven't started, but that's the direction I'm going.
Now, everyone writes, you know, of you as having an influence, your career being, you know, legendary and storied. Do you think that you yourself, have you had an impact on this country, good or bad?
Well, probably a little bit. You know, there's a difference between influence and power. Journalists do not have any power. They do have some influence because they create the climate within which politicians are judged. And I think I've had some little influence there, but it was never the quest for influence that motivated me. It was a quest for a better country, and it may be presumptuous to think that one person can do much about it, but if you don't try, then you give up. And I've always tried, and I've always felt that trying was almost as important as realizing it, because we all have to have hopes for the future. We have to have aspirations to make Canada a greater country, and I'm not going to give that up, even if I have to search till the day I die.
And the funniest part I read in the book was the last part where you say that as they're loading you up into your casket, you'll probably wish that they'll say, "I thought he moved."
That's right. I thought I saw him move. Well, that may or may not happen, but I'm praying it does.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today. And
thank you.
And congratulations on a fine book. And
thank
I do
you,
recommend it, because I sat up for about 2 or 3 days and just read it straight through.
Is that right? Well, listen, I'm very grateful to you, and I'm glad you're doing this.
And the book is called Here Be Dragons, Telling Tales of People, Passion, and Power, $42.99 Canadian, published by McClelland and Stewart, of which you'll be signing copies of that tonight at Chapters, right?
That's right, at 7:30.
7:30 at the Chapters on Robson and Howe. Peter C. Newman here on thecommentary.ca. I'm Joseph Plenum.